Welcome to another edition of Truth Talk. I am your host, Chance George, along with my co-host, Paul Webster. It is April the 14th, 2013. We are doing a pre-recorded interview with a gentleman by the name of Andrew Johnson from the United Kingdom. He will be our guest tonight talking everything 9/11. There's a lot of myths out there and misconceptions of what's going on. You can Google search on the internet and spend countless hours going through disinformation, or you could simply check the evidence. So you could go to checktheevidence.com. That is our guest website, I believe. Mr. Webster is probably going to start off with a question or two. Paul?
Thanks, Chance. How you doing, Mr. Johnson?
Hi, I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Good. I appreciate you coming on as your a leading expert, I would say, I guess, in the realm. And for new listeners and new people, I'm sure we get a lot of traffic on our news, and we really don't know where it's coming from, but I'm assuming it's all new people to the concept. And what would be one of the first things, is somebody that's gone by the government story, somebody that believes the official story and knows nothing else, what would be one of the first things you could tell them as a clincher that would really open them up to the whole, like, so many of the misconceptions have been vetted out, and like, I mean, the thermite thing, for example, it was proven to be false, I heard, and who even knows anymore? There's so many things that are up and down and right and wrong, and that it kind of throws a stick in the spokes in the progress. So right. What would you say is a real clincher to somebody for them to look up as the first thing that they could indisputably have to agree with you on?
Well, I think, one of the things which I first came across was the time which it takes for the towers to disappear if you watch the videos. And for me, that was kind of one of the first things that I really felt I could prove was, you know, false based on what the official story said. And I, you know, that's how that's how I got into the position I'm in now with 9/11, was because I started re-examining how the towers, you know, disappeared. I mean, and I use the word disappeared deliberately because many other people would use the word collapse. And initially I used the word collapse as well, just like everybody else. But if you go and look at the videos again, you'll see, if you look very carefully, that the towers didn't actually collapse. They actually turned to dust in midair, and that right there disproves the official story. Once you observe and understand that, you don't really need to be much of an expert. You just need to watch the videos and then look at the aftermath. That in essence will show you that the official story cannot be true. And in where you go from there, you know, is a bit of a there's a lot of different places you can go to from there. But the starting point is for me, at least, the disappearance of the towers.
Now, on our episode page, that will be on our Blog Talk page when this goes live, we get to have five different pictures. And one of the pictures is a still frame shot of four frames, and it shows core column towers going from, I believe at least 40 of them or so in 70-foot towers at least. And then the next shot is them, the first one's of solid steel, the next one is them kind of, it almost looks like they're vibrating, and then the next one they're turning to dust, and the last shot of the four, they're literally blowing away into thin air dustification. Now, you're completely familiar with this shot, I'm taking a guess.
Yes, I am indeed, and I think you've got right there one of the real, to me, hesitate to use the cliche smoking gun, and it's a kind of a gun giving off dust, as it were, rather than smoking, because it's dust that we're talking about, not smoke. But yes, you know, this sequence of four frames in particular, I think, is very powerful in showing that the official story cannot be true, because you've got 70 stories of unsupported steel turning to dust before your very eyes. And we have multiple videos of this too, so you're not just dealing with a set of, you know, four still photographs taken by one person. You're actually dealing with several sets of photographs. I think there's two or three sets of photographs showing this, and also I've seen now I think about six or seven different video clips showing exactly the same thing. So what mechanism, you know, is causing that? What mechanism is causing that to happen?
It seems to me that there's a lot of different angles where people are getting into stuff like there's planes versus no planes. We're looking at the possibility of holograms. There's the thermite group of people who are arguing that perspective. There's a whole different fourth generation mini nuke angle that's coming out. There's, of course, what you're familiar with Dr. Judy Woods, who is talking about directive energy weapons and some sort of black ops operation. Now, with all the different possibilities out there and the different stuff to get into, how would you first lay into some of the things that Judy Woods is proposing in her basic forensic novel that she wrote?
Well, I think novel's not quite the right word there. I would say study, analysis, documentation. It's definitely not a novel because it's fully referenced to, you know, all the sources of information that are used. But that book is a very good starting point in terms of understanding what happened to the World Trade Center. Now, you know, many people have different areas of interest in 9/11. Some are more interested in the political side, or, you know, why it was done and that side of things. And that book doesn't really answer those questions particularly. What that book shows you is, you know, what actually happened to the World Trade Center towers in meticulous detail, using a number of areas of evidence. And if you keep that in the main focus of attention, you will come to understand exactly what happened. And like understanding a crime scene, you know, once you understand the crime scene, you can begin then perhaps to go off with a little more confidence to look at, you know, maybe who did the crime, who had the means, motive, and opportunity. Once you understand what that crime actually consisted of, in other words, you know, if you'd already previously come to the conclusion that hijackers were involved, but you'll see in that study that there's no evidence of anything to do with hijackers or hijacked planes, they become entirely irrelevant, actually, to the question of what happened to the buildings. And that you know, you just have to put that as another question for another you know, branch of investigation. So you have to really try and separate these things out, and a lot of people just want the whole thing. You know, they want to say, well, they'll say to me, well, Andrew, you're telling me that the buildings, you know, disappeared, so what happened to the planes? And then I have to go into a separate explanation of that. So there is no doubt in my mind at all that Dr. Wood's book is the most comprehensive description and explanation of what happened to the World Trade Center. And it will tell you, to some extent, how it was done, how it was destroyed. What essentially it shows you another similar technology within a, you know, a set of evidence that was, it's actually to do with something called the Hutchison effect, which is actually a set of energy effects. And that set of evidence is also laid out in the book and essentially compared to, you know, the set of evidence that was found at the World Trade Center. And then you will see within that those two things are a precise match. What is shown in the effects of this Hutchison effect, which we know we haven't discussed yet, but we can if you wanted to, that matches up to what happened at the scene of the World Trade Center precisely.
Okay, speaking of the Hutchins effect, now he's a Canadian scientist, correct?
Yeah, John Hutchison, he is an experimental physicist, you might call him, and he's one of these guys who has developed his own experiments in his own way. He hasn't really followed any textbooks. He was originally trying to reproduce some of the effects that Nikola Tesla had, you know, come across in his own experiments in the 1930s and 40s, and probably before that even. Quite a long time before that, actually, probably 1900s, 1910, 1920, that sort of time frame. And John Hutchinson, for example, collected equipment over a period of years, a lot of it army surplus equipment, and he was able to generate various effects using different types of energy mixed together. He was mixing together microwave energy, electrostatic fields, he was mixing together magnetic fields, and sometimes a radioactive source. He basically was able to sort of generate these effects, and he was able to create things like levitation, where objects would lift off the ground. He was able to make metal bend anomalously without any heat and form almost jellyfy. He was able to generate certain temporal effects where, for example, these effects that would happen on the metal would continue even though the equipment was all switched off, you know, and the energy had been discharged. But some of these metal samples still showed changes in the structure. Most of the effects were confined to a region in his apartment, but sometimes they would take place further away, you know, within a few hundred yards of where he lived, and people would have things, you know, sort of falling off the TV or, you know, sort of breaking off. And many of these things were videoed. People have, if you read up on this on the internet, you'll immediately come across, oh, this guy, you know, is a fraud because he, for example, did an experiment with a fake UFO, and there was a wire, and he was claiming this was anti-gravity, and it wasn't. He was just holding it on a wire. And you read all this stuff, you know, on the internet. But the facts of the matter are that John Hutchinson was visited in 1983 for a period of 4 months by Colonel John Alexander, who some people may be familiar with because he was involved with the so-called remote viewing program in the 80s, which ran out of Stanford Research Institute. He was one of the folks that was involved in that. So John Alexander visited John Hutchinson in 1983, and essentially he was able to film some of the experiments, you know, producing some of these effects. And at that time, John wasn't able to reproduce these effects reliably, but since that time, he has sort of honed the technique, and he's reproduced them on film on many occasions for a number of companies and a number of documentaries. So, in essence, what actually happened to the World Trade Center, you can see, for example, witnesses were levitated. You can hear their accounts, such as David Hanscher, the New York Daily News photographer. He was levitated and carried a block. You can hear the account of Rennie Davila, who also experienced some type of force interfering with his bag. We have the story which came out last year. The chap Blair was his first name, I think, or Blaze. I need to go and check that story out. He felt that he'd floated down about 20 stories, or that's what he seemed to have done. But he was in a bit of a confusion. This is why while the building is coming apart, he floated down. It's like he was falling, but he landed, and he was uninjured, and he walked out, you know, from the building being destroyed. And his story was on Fox News last year. And we've got pictures of cars turned upside down. We've got pictures of a fire truck, one picture of a fire truck turned upside down with a car next to it, you know, the right way up. And, you know, again, it's like all these things. Once you become aware of this evidence and you start to investigate it, you uncover a different story. Because if you go for this nuke hypothesis or this thermite theory or the other variations on these things, bombs in the building, these do not explain all of the effects. They do not explain how you've got people being levitated and they're not burned, you know. They do not explain the paper being unburned whilst the rest of the building is turned to dust. They do not explain why you've got one car turned upside down and the one next one to it is the right way up.
Can we prove to any 99 out of 100 people, though, if you blew a bomb up a far distance away, it's going to push a lot of air. And a plane hitting a building is like a bomb, and a lot of air got pushed, and that's what the air went under those people. Is there a way to scientifically prove to people that that is impossible for that to happen?
Well, I think there is, but, you know, again, with many people, you know, they, whatever evidence they show you, they won't accept it. For example,
Are you at the point now that it's not about the facts? It's about the psychological issues with the general public.
A lot of it is that, yes. I mean, going back to your question about scientific proof, well, one thing that Dr. Wood points out, and I, you know, obviously agree with her, because you can check this for yourselves by looking at the available evidence on things like the USGS website. And if you take the USGS website as a legitimate source of data, which, you know, can be verified, then which you would hope that it would, because a lot of scientific institutions use data from that website or from their publications in their own research. One of the things that you can find on that website is the seismic signature of the destruction of the World Trade Center. And in other words, you can find out how long the ground shook for when...
And the radius of the blast...
Well, not so much the radius of the blast, but you can find how long the ground shook for, and the amount to which it shook, you know, the level of shaking, the seismic vibrations, as it were. You can find what happened on 9/11 when the towers came down, and that seismic signal is not consistent with the size of the building having come to the ground. And Dr. Wood goes to some length in her book and on her website to compare the World Trade Center's seismic signature with the King Dome in Seattle, which was brought down by controlled demolition. And that was a smaller building, and also it was spread out over a, you know, greater area, because it was a sports, you know, sports dome. So with the surface area on the ground was greater than the World Trade Center, yet the seismic signature was somewhat larger, and the ground shook for longer. I think it shook for 12 seconds. And for the World Trade Center, the ground shook for 8 seconds, which doesn't make any sense, because that, if you work out the so-called free fall time, where if you dropped an object from the top of the World Trade Center and measured the time it took to reach the ground, ignoring air resistance, it would have taken roughly 9.5 seconds. But if you look at the USGS data, it says that the ground shook for only 8 seconds. So this is, again, as we, you know, going back to the thing with the steel that we mentioned earlier, disappearing, you have to explain how a building can have come down to the ground but not cause the ground to shake. You know, and there's no explanation for that. So it really is as simple as that. The building did not hit the ground in solid form. And why I'm going to the length of explaining that is that if you crash a plane into a building and the building falls down because of that, whether it's because of a resulting fire or whether it's a shock wave or some combination of the two, the building would have hit the ground. Therefore, there would have been, you know, a commensurate seismic signature. And that did not happen. So that in of itself, again, shows the official story is untrue, but it also disproves the idea that bombs were used to, you know, which is what I originally thought a few years ago. I thought they'd used bombs, and I bought into this thermite story as well later on in 2005, 2006, when that started to come out. So it rules out those two theories, and it also rules out the nuke theory as well, because, again, the nuke theory says that the building would have had to, most of the building would have had to reach the ground, and therefore the ground would have shaken, and therefore you would have had a seismic signature and everything that went with that. And going back to the psychology, I think one of the ways which has been very powerful, and I actually heard somebody say this the other day, somebody who should be informed about what I just told you about the seismic signature, that person said, oh, yes, and the buildings disappeared, and all the steel was shipped to China. And there's no evidence that that is true. That latter statement, is there was no evidence it's true.
You said the statement, Mr. Johnson, Andrew Johnson, joining us from the UK, author, teacher, lecturer in maths, is that right?
To give a little bit about my background, I do a bit of part-time, lecturing, not much lecturing, I do a little bit of lecturing. I do part-time tuition for an organisation called the Open University, and my background is in something called software engineering. Originally, I did that for about 20 years, and that's basically a form of computer programming, but it's also involved with solving engineering problems which involve computer programs. So, you know, that's what I was involved with. It's a very analytical process. And, you know, I wrote in languages like C and C++ and assembly languages and things like that. So it's a very kind of logical, technical type of activity. And then I sort of branched out into education. And I mainly now work in student support for students with disabilities. And I do a bit of lecturing in a computing-related subject for the Open University. So... yeah, so it's you do get involved with a little bit of maths. You know, I did a little bit of what's called control theory in the software engineering that I did. That was one of the first jobs that I did, and you know, you come across bits of maths like flow rates and this sort of thing. So I've been involved with I did actually do a little bit of maths tuition. I've done a little bit of that, but not in a very high sort of level.
Well, with those kind of credentials, I'm sure your math's higher than regular people's.
Well, typically when people get into 9/11 truth and different conspiracy theories, a lot of the time you get the typical ad hominem attack of, well, this guy is crazy. He's off his rocker. But, I mean, when you're talking about you're the type of person who is spending years in computer programming and computer sciences and all these different aspects, you're obviously a very well-educated and smart person. So it'd be crazy to say that you're just pulling imaginary theories out of thin air. You have research and evidence to back up some of the things that are going on the internet about 9/11. Whereas some people just always reference, well, I watched a YouTube video. Now, you personally compiled, I believe it was a witness testimony. Is that correct? You did a survey on witnesses and came up with your own study. Is that true?
Yeah, essentially that, you know, you picked on really what I would class as the only bit of original research that I've done, you know, original research. You know, I've collected a lot of research together and kind of, you know, tried to sort of summarize it and that sort of thing. But yeah, the witness account thing, what I did there was, and this goes back to re-examining the plane stories, and it's a very, very difficult area for people for a number of reasons, because we've seen those plane crashes as, you know, some of the most famous sort of bits of news footage in history almost. And if you were to suggest to people that there was something wrong with those plane crashes and they didn't actually happen, you know, as they were shown, it becomes very difficult for people to sort of accept that. But part of the reason for doing that witness research, that was back in 2007, so this is almost 6 years ago now. I forget what the exact date was on that article that you're mentioning, but we did, that was done to help with a court case, which again a lot of people have no knowledge of, because the 9/11 truth movement essentially covered up that court case. And that was a court case that Dr. Morgan Reynolds started under the auspices of an attorney called Jerry Liepart, who was based in Connecticut. And Morgan Reynolds wanted to sue the people that produced the technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center. And as part and parcel of that, he wanted to demonstrate that what was discussed in regard to the plane crashes in the technical reports could not have been true. And I think he showed that very well in previous research that he'd done. But we wanted to submit evidence to court which could be, you know, used in theory, this research that we did with the witness accounts, and I sort of finished it off, but I didn't start it. I had some help at the beginning, but I kind of finished it off. We could have taken witnesses into the courtroom, you know, based on what was in those testimonies in the New York Times collection, which, you know, maybe I'll describe that now. Essentially, what we wanted to do was describe and show that what witnesses saw at the World Trade Center as regards the second crash, which is the Flight 175 crashing into the tower, there were some extremely odd inconsistencies in the witness record. And a lot of people say, you know, well, everyone saw the planes, you know, and for you to say that they didn't see a plane or saw something else, that's just ridiculous. But if you go, as I did, to the New York Times website and you download the 500 witness accounts that are there, and the reference is on my website, and that you can download the text versions that I generated, which makes it easier to look for the text that I looked for, and you study what the witnesses said about the second plane crash, you will find some very peculiar things coming out. You know, for example, I should maybe get a couple of these up. I think I'll do that, because then I can actually read out a couple of the texts, because it's not, you know, it's not very long. And if I get that text up with me now, then I can sort of read that out to you, so that I'm not reading the wrong thing.
While you're pulling that up, I'll just reference for people. Basically, what he's done is Andrew has gone and downloaded all of the witness reports. He's gone into a search engine program and put in certain specific terms, like how close people were to the plane, impact, stuff like that. And he's compiled statistics and different stories where from some of the numbers that I was hearing from him, there was only like one person who heard a plane and a crash at certain times, and he's gone into quite detail. So when he gets his numbers and all his lines out there, this is a very compelling study. I watched one of the videos I discovered, I believe it was on Rich Planet. It's where I've seen you as a guest number of times, and there's quite the number of evidence that you compiled just from these admitted witness reports in the paper.
That's right, and I mean, you know, anyone can go and check this, and this is what's vitally important. You know, I've got the witness account in front of me, which I'll read at the section of, but you know, anyone can go and check this. I don't have any, you know, I don't have anybody in the military. I don't know anybody in the military. I don't know any officials in the US or the UK. You know, I don't know anybody. All of this that I'm telling you is based on publicly available information. And this particular one, for example, I'll pick out a couple of accounts, and this is from what was called the oral histories, the 9/11 oral histories, 500 accounts and what these 500 accounts were people that were actually at the World Trade Center site on 9/11, helping people, you know, pulling them out of the rubble and, you know, trying to sort of rescue people, fix them up if they were injured. And it's a collection of firefighters' accounts and emergency medical technician, EMT, folks who are, you know, treating people's wounds and stuff like that. And this particular one is from firefighter this was, file 911-0114. At that time, Chief Ganshi was behind me, and he thought there was another explosion in the North Tower. And that's when I turned around and said, "Chief, listen, there is a second plane that hit the other tower." He was like, no, we have another explosion. I said, "No, Chief, I witness it. I watched the plane hit the other tower." He was like, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yes, Chief, I'm 100% positive. I watched the second plane hit the tower." So you've got two people stood next to each other, presumably, right next to each other, and they can't agree that the plane has crashed, into the tower. And that's just one example. There are a number of these. I mean, I've just literally picked out a couple of these. If this was on a PowerPoint, I use for some of the talks I've given. And then our another one, David Sandvik, file number 911-0375, page 4. We start heading down the block and we get down to, I guess, about Church Street and the second plane hit. And I remember just being underneath. I never heard the motor of the plane, the sound of the engines. We just heard the explosion. You felt the explosion. And looking straight up and seeing that fireball that you see on the news, but we're underneath, looking up now at it. So this guy, you know, he's right underneath it, doesn't hear the plane. So what's going on? And then I established, as you were saying, I went through all these accounts, you know, and these figures might be slightly incorrect. You know, I'm not saying that I spent like, you know, I wasn't paid to do this. I didn't have a research budget to do this. I just did it in my own time. But I came up that I've looked at the 500 accounts and I managed to establish that 96 witnesses out of those 500 were near the World Trade Center, as in within half a mile, at the time of this second crash, the crash of Flight 175, and a further 21 witnesses were inside one of the World Trade Center buildings at the time of the second crash. This gave a total of 117 people who were at or near or inside the World Trade Center during the second crash. Only 19 of the witnesses near the World Trade Center reported actually seeing this plane before the crash. So only 20% of them reported seeing it. Now, of course, that's not perhaps so extraordinary. You know, if they're busy, you know, pulling people out or treating people's wounds or whatever, maybe that's not so unusual. But I think perhaps more unusual is that only 20 of these people actually reported hearing the plane. So only 21% of these witnesses heard the plane. That's 20 out of 117. And then only 8 of the witnesses near the World Trade Center actually reported seeing and hearing the plane before it supposedly crashed. So that's only about 8% of them. So when you look at those figures, you see that, and you know, you'll even get stories. I didn't put this in this PowerPoint, but if you look at the article, you find it in there. I think it's one or two people didn't describe seeing a plane at all. They described seeing a missile. And then some people said they thought that a Cessna plane had crashed, a light aircraft. And some people said, I didn't even know that planes were involved in this until I got home the next day. And, you know, I saw it on the TV that it was a plane crash. You know, I mean, what's that about?
Now, as a person who frequents the Toronto International Airport on a daily basis through work, I can tell you that just even being within, like you say, a half mile of the airport itself, you definitely know every time a plane is coming in and out. And in the YouTube videos of the 9/11 incident where you all see the second plane crash in and you hear the lady scream, it is a noticeable rush of air and sound and impact. So for 20% of the people who were there to even say they saw or heard it, like, this is – it would be undeniable that you heard a plane rush into the middle of a downtown section like that. It should be unquestionable. This should be 100% of people.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, you know, you'd think that you'd get a much higher percentage. Now, of course, the skeptics would say, oh, well, you know, it's obviously a very traumatic incident, and so, you know, there's great confusion there, and, you know, and so therefore the people's memory would be affected by the trauma and this type of thing. And there's probably an element of truth in that. But I you know, I got the feeling from looking through these accounts, and particularly you will find if you do go to the original documents, there are some interesting redactions as well. For example, there's one account that has 10 whole pages redacted from it. So, you know, then that's another little branch of that research that I think you find on my website. So I didn't put that in the book, but it's on my website.
It's amazing someone would retract what they thought they saw as their witness testimony. So that's pretty damning in itself.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, for example, David Hansher, who was the photographer that I mentioned earlier on, he was a photographer for the New York Daily News. And there's an interview with him from October 2001, I think it was, when he was on the Charlie Rose PBS broadcast. He describes being levitated a block, but also he was caught, the poor guy, he was caught in the destruction of both of the towers, because he was there when Tower 1 went down, and he had to be rescued from that, although I don't think he was in a particularly bad way, and then he was still, you know, trying to take photographs for the second one, and he had to be rescued again when the second one came down, he broke his leg. But what happened, he took a picture, you can see this picture, if you just Google David Hanscher, which is H-A-N-D-S-C-H-U-H. If you Google his name and then a photograph, he got a photograph that he took supposedly just as Flight 175 had crashed. It's a very iconic picture, this actually. It's been reused a lot. But if you look at that picture, you can see the sort of fireball emerging from the face of the tower. But you can't see any of the large pieces of plane falling down. You can't see any wing sections breaking off. You can't see the tail section breaking off. You know, you can just see a few little bits of the what looks like the aluminium cladding and a few sort of, you know, smaller chunks of material. But that's the other problem with the World Trade Center plane crash, is that if you have an object like that, which is essentially made of light materials, it's essentially a hollow tube, it would break apart when it crashed. It wouldn't get absorbed into the building, as was shown in the videos. So what the hell is going on with these crashes?
It's pretty amazing, not only the different witness testimony, like you're saying, but just the different footages that was taken that day. Now, I know that when you were on Rich Planet, I believe is the name of the show.
That's right.
The host of that, he came up with a very unique bit of reporting where he goes through about 50 different angles from that day. And at first, people were kind of trying to say that, you know, this footage looks like the plane's coming in from a horizontal angle, and there's other ones kind of referenced as the ball, where it appears to come down from the sky as like a dive bomb. And he goes through and basically debunks some of the mystery behind it and shows, pinpointing out the different angles of approach and the patterns from the radar. Could you give a little bit of a further detail of what was going on there?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, I mean, that's my friend Richard D. Hall, and, you know, again, whenever I bring him up, I have to thank him sort of very deeply for what he's done, particularly with that program that you mentioned there, richplanet.tv, and I recommend people, you know, go to that website and watch all the videos that are there, and they'll find them. If they're interested in this sort of material, they'll find a real sort of gold mine of stuff there to work through. And he's very thorough in what he does. He also has an engineering background, as I do. He worked in electronic engineering, and he also did bits of software similar to what I did. So originally, what he did was he watched the September Clues film, which was done by Simon Shack. In I think 2007 when that came out, which looks at how these plane crashes were presented in the videos, and he then came up with, as you mentioned there, this ball clip, which I think was from NBC News, where the plane shot from an angle, sort of quite a high angle, apparently from a news helicopter, I think, looked like it was coming down in a sort of dive bomb. And then it crashes, and it looks like a ball. And he originally thought that this was some type of craft, and wasn't a plane. But then, as you say, he reanalyzed this, because he did a revised version of this analysis. You're looking at more of the videos, because I think there were since 9/11. I think there are now. Surfaced the ones that have been released. Some were given to NIST apparently for their investigation. I think there are something like 56 different clips of Flight 175, or the alleged Flight 175, crashing into the tower. And some of them are very shaky, so you can't really see, you know, much of anything. Some of them are, you know, you only see a bit of it, and you don't see the actual impact. And then, so Richard ended up with about, I think it's something like 26 or 23, I can't remember the exact number without watching the video again. And he took these clips, and they're all taken from different angles, you know, from around the World Trade Center towers. And he then mapped those views. He worked out where they'd been shot from on the street plan of New York, and he used a freely downloadable tool called Google SketchUp, which you can correctly orientate 3D models in space, and you also put in a ground map of New York City, and he put in the Empire State Building. He put in the Statue of Liberty, I think, in there as well in the computer model that he generated, and then he essentially spun around the viewpoint to the place where the video was taken, played the video. And he had a red line drawn in the 3D model, which represented the 3D path of Flight 175. And you can see as he does this analysis that he spins the model round, overlays the video clip, spins it round again, overlays the next one. And from that, he was able to show after, I think it took him about 6 months to make this. You know, it was a long time. From that, he was able to show that the videos did indeed all match. All the videos matched, and they matched the pretty much very closely, you know, to within a sort of an acceptable margin of error. They matched the original radar data, which was in a report by Daniel R. Bauer, that you pronounce his surname. That was an official report presented, I think, in 2003. Possibly to NIST or one of the other organizations, I'm not sure. But so that radar data and all the video clips matched. And this seemed to then go against what was proposed in the September Clues film, which said that there wasn't a plane at all involved. And what was actually used was computer graphics, and they'd inserted computer graphics into the news footage, you know, either into the live feed or after the event. And these plane images, therefore, were not actually real, but they were actually computer graphics, and not very good ones, according to some criticism of them. But then we essentially, I actually had some communication with Simon Shack regarding the creation of this film, and I've written that up in an article, and I don't think he was particularly happy about certain things. He was very uncomfortable with Richard's analysis of the ball clip initially, and then he didn't really seem to feel what Richard had done was totally valid. Yeah, so Simon Shack wasn't particularly happy with that, and again, I've written an article about that and how. Nobody.
To be disproven, I guess.
I think it goes a bit beyond that, actually. I know what you mean, though. People that don't like to have, their theories kind of disproved, as it were. But I have a feeling that in Simon Shack's case, because of the evidence that I gathered about that he was up to something. And he has some unusual connections, Simon Shack, as well, which he ended up admitting on his forum after a period of time. So going back to Richard's analysis, what it appears is that if you look at the physical evidence and you for example consider Newton's third law, which is says that to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, and you then apply that to the face of the towers, you will see that and you understand why planes are made out of aluminium and carbon fiber and things like this, and buildings are made out of box girder steel, 3-inch box girder steel, or well, maybe not made out of that, but they are supported by structures which are made out of that, perhaps I should say more accurately. And you understand that, if you fire a plane at a building, the force on the building is the same as the force on the plane, because that's essentially what Newton's law says. So essentially the thing that's going to end up with the most damage is the weaker material. And so if I was to ask you the question, which is made of the strongest material, was the World Trade Center superstructure made of the strongest material, or was the wings of the plane made of the strongest material? I mean, you know, what would be your guess?
Well, based on the fact that as a person who goes to construction sites every day and I deliver supplies into these construction sites, which are massive steel column buildings like you're talking about, just being on site, I look down and I think there is no way that this building fell like this. There's no way this is a weak structure. There's no way a plane went in one side of it and the nose came out the other side of it. Right. I'm not a plane expert, but I do know that the building is definitely stronger than what that plane would be. That would be my guess.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, I point out to people that, you know, that what they will say in response to that is they'll say, well, you know, the plane was traveling at 500 miles an hour, Andrew, so that's why it made the hole. And, you know, that will swing it for a lot of people. But unfortunately, if that was really a valid argument and was physically correct, then you would never need to develop anything like, well, not necessarily need to develop anything like armor-piercing bullets, because all you'd have to do was send your projectile fast enough and it would go through anything. In fact, you know, you could make...
The structure is made of steel and everything, but a lot of times buildings, the outside are just mere glass.
Yeah, right.
The walls of the I'm not sure what they're made of, but in my mind they could have, for all I know, been a layer of siding, and then a layer of what do you call that stuff, insulation, and then a layer of drywall. Okay. And I would say, someone that's listening, it would say like a plane doing 500 miles an hour is sure going to take out glass and drywall.
Yeah, and indeed it did. I think you can see that quite clearly. But also what it took out, if you look at the pictures in the official NIST technical reports, for example, if you want to download the NIST technical reports so that you're not going onto somebody's blog, you know, and you know that they haven't doctored the images or photoshopped them or whatever, you can go and look at NIST technical reports and you can see in those pictures that there are segments of the girders which have been cut through. And the segments of those girders within the inside, you know, all the glass is gone, as you said, and you know, whatever the drywall or whatever was in there in between, you know, in the front sections, and some of the aluminium sections have been cut through. The aluminium's not so bad because that's that's a sort of lighter material, a less dense material than the steel. But you'll even see that these steel columns in a number of places have been cut through with a quarter inch aluminium windstrut. And go and see it, go and look at it. Don't take my word for it. And this is physically impossible. And also the other thing that was observed in Morgan Reynolds' court case was the problem with deceleration. I mean, you think of an IndyCar crash, for example, where something crashes into the barrier at high speed. What will typically happen, not every single time, but what will typically happen is when it goes in at an angle, it will bounce off and the car will spin round. You get the forward motion translated into rotational movement because the energy is transferred from the forward motion into a rotational motion.
Path of least resistance for it.
Yeah, and so what we should have seen with the plane crash is that the plane would have been at a very slight angle and the tail section would have broken off and spun out somewhere and essentially fallen into the street, and you didn't see any large pieces of the plane breaking off anywhere. You allegedly saw the nose coming out of the other side of the building, but again, this doesn't really make a lot of sense when you consider the actual structure of the building. And you look at, you, for example, you can look at pictures of the construction where they haven't really got much of building there except the interior, you know, the 236 exterior columns and the 47 interior steel columns. And when you see that structure, as your co-host said, you realize that these buildings are extremely strong in construction.
Now, after I've seen, like you're talking about, personally, the building's construction, but documentaries on the Twin Towers themselves, these were buildings that were meant to get hit with planes. They were meant to withstand century-long hurricanes. They were... They were a sore thumb in the skyline. They were meant to be hit with something. As you saw, the Eiffel Tower was hit with a smaller plane. It burned up a few stories, was put out, and still standing to this day. So this isn't like they didn't expect it to happen, and they didn't think it could one day potentially happen. So these were well planned out and thought out buildings that were deliberately taken down. Now we're going to move into a very quick short break. I'm going to play a quick intro here, and we'll be back with our guest. All right, Paul and I are back again with our guest, Andrew Johnson. He is all the way from the UK. He's an author, researcher, lecturer. He studied in things like math, physics, computer science, software engineering. He's spent some time educating and lecturing. He also teaches courses on technologies in practice. He began doing his research on 9/11 around September of 2004, and I believe he was also a member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. So, well, welcome back to the show, Andrew Johnson. I wanted to maybe get into some of the different angles. Did you want to discuss any of your research and what you would say the truth about the Pentagon or different angles of that scenario?
Yeah, I mean, just perhaps I'd like maybe go on to the Pentagon in a bit, but you mentioned the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group there, and that was a kind of a bit of a wake-up call for me personally as to how the cover-up has been working and how it's essentially had a number of layers to it, as I've come to understand things.
Okay, in my notes, I have disinfo agents written down, so maybe we'll just skip right into that,
okay.
And then we'll come back to the Pentagon in a bit. So, disinformation agents, a COINTELPRO, it's something that became very popular in the 60s movements, where the government decided to infiltrate a lot of operations and steer it kind of the way controlled that they want. And you're basically saying that not only was this happening with 9/11, but you were personally involved once you got into the Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Could you talk about some of the people? I believe Stephen Jones is one of the main characters. Is this correct?
That's what I've gathered the evidence to show that's pretty much the case as far as I'm concerned. It was kind of a bit of a shock to me, I suppose, at the time. And I didn't really liken it to COINTELPRO, but I suppose that's what it was. It's not something I use a lot, because it's one of those terms that now has sort of been a bit overused in the alternative knowledge community. I tried to focus on what he actually said and did, you know, and how I interacted with him, and how that essentially became inconsistent with the facts that were available as I understood them to be. And to sort of clarify that a bit. It was Stephen, when we talked earlier on about the collapse, or I should have said disappearance of the towers, and how I got into that was looking at this freefall time, and I posted this little, really it's just one of the equations of motion, and I posted this little sort of calculation, I suppose you'd call it, on a physics forum. In 2005, and it attracted quite a lot of attention on that forum, a lot of debunkers, but they couldn't find an error in the calculation, which was very simple, you know, and I was pretty sure it was correct, and I put it on this forum, and I think that somebody must have been watching that forum for people that actually sort of had some you know educational background as I did, basic though it may have been. And then Stephen E. Jones, he invited me to join the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group that he was setting up along with Jim Fetzer at the end of 2005. And I later came to understand that this was not long after these technical reports had been published, the NIST technical reports, National Institute for Standards and Technology, which were the technical reports about the destruction of the towers. And they were published at 10,000 pages of documents in 2005. And, so he invited me into this group, and their goal was essentially to draw attention to, the inconsistencies in the story of 9/11, and they were going to do things like write press releases and say, you know, Dr. such and such says this, and Professor so and so says that. So thereby, you know, supposedly giving those statements more academic clout, you know, because you've got these so-called qualified academics behind these statements, you know. And I later found out that it was quite peculiar the way that they asked me to join, because they asked me to join as a full member of this group, and they had sort of prerequisites for what you had to be for a full member. And I didn't have those prerequisites. For a full member, you needed to be, professor at a university, and have a tenured position or something. I can't remember the exact thing that you're supposed to have. But I didn't have those things. I just have a bachelor's degree. It's in computer science and physics. I don't have any advanced degrees. Yet they'd asked me to join as a full member, which was odd. And anyway, I then got involved with reviewing this Steve Nee Jones paper, as he called it, about the use of thermite to destroy the steel, to melt through the steel in the towers. And he then showed this video clip of some molten material coming out of the corner, one corner, and about across, well, it's actually on one floor of the building, dripping out. You have this sort of yellowy orange, apparently hot material dripping down the outside of the tower. And he was claiming that this proved that there was thermite being, you know, used to cut through the steel. And then moments after this this clip, the tower sort of disappeared. And so he was claiming that thermite must have been involved. And I basically trusted this guy. I went onto the Brigham Young University website. I looked at his faculty page, you know, with a picture of him and his research background and so on. I assumed this guy was legitimate. But it turns out that he started saying things which weren't true. For example, he stated molten aluminium has a silvery appearance at all temperatures in daylight conditions. That's what he said. And that is not true. It does not. Molten aluminium can, under daylight conditions, appear to be orange or appears to glow if you heat it up enough. Sure enough, if you just heat it up a bit and you heat it up to 600 degrees centigrade or so, or 630, whatever it is, I can't remember the exact temperature, the aluminium will melt, and it will flow, and it will have a silvery appearance. But if you keep on heating it, it will glow. So he was needing, apparently, to put out false information about the nature of molten aluminium. And I later came to understand that this was because of what actually happened to the metal, or to some of the metal, in the World Trade Center. It underwent some strange type of process which made it appear to be molten, but this process didn't create significant heat. It may have created a little bit of heat, but not nowhere near what you'd experience in the process of melting the aluminium. So he I think it was, let's see, by early 2007, I'd started to have some reservations about what was going on in the scholars group. And it was at that time, in early 2007, when I first came into contact with Dr. Judy Wood. So we're going back just over 6 years now. I've been into contact with her. And she was pointing out all these very strange effects that she'd catalogued in the 40,000 pictures that she'd studied, one of which was these metal effects. And she felt that this Steve Nee Jones character was putting out this sort of information to cover up some of the effects that she was documenting. Now, initially, I wasn't sure about this. I thought it seemed like pretty far-fetched, you know, that somebody would go to these lengths, because otherwise this guy seemed totally legitimate. You know, he had a sense of humor. He seemed like he wanted to know the truth about 9/11, and so on. But over those months, that this original story of thermite began to sort of change, and he then said, well, it wasn't necessarily thermite, it might have been thermate. So you add sulfur to the thermite and you come out with thermate. And then he later changed it and said, well, we know that thermite doesn't explode, and people heard all these explosions, so there must have been explosives as well. and or maybe it was nanothermite, because we know that nanothermite can explode, and that's what caused the explosive sounds. And you'll still hear this claim today that the nanothermite will you know, create explosions. But I've not seen evidence that this is true. Apparently the military are supposed to have developed nanothermite, but I don't know what they use it for. I certainly don't think they use it to demolish buildings. What we do know that they use thermite for is they use a thermite grenade to destroy confidential papers, because it burns very hot, so you get a very complete burning of things like paper. And there are some demonstrations of this on some of the videos, and I believe there are some documentation which shows that the military use it for this sort of thing. But that's sort of a side issue, really. And then Steve Nee Jones was asked how this thermite was planted in the buildings, before the buildings were destroyed. And he said, "Oh well, maybe they used paint-on thermite. In other words, somebody painted it on." And I just thought, "Well, that's ridiculous. That is just totally ridiculous that he would suggest that." And so I began to collect the evidence with the help of Dr. Wood about what this guy was actually saying at some of his public meetings. And he was the first guy to come out with this description of space beams, because he claimed that Dr. Wood's research was about space beams. And this is an expression that Dr. Wood has never used, and it's not in her book. So, of course, to call something space beams, which he was one of the first people to use it, or ray beams from space, or beam from space, was what he actually said. So this was a way of making it sound ridiculous. And a lot of people, you'll still see this repeated now, and we've got this alien scientist character, who's Jeremy Riss. He keeps insisting that Judy Wood has talked about space lasers. She's never used that term, yet Jeremy Riss, who claims to have a video channel investigating the science of truth, says that this is what she said. So why is a person like him, for example, claiming to be using the science of truth, going around telling lies? And we have the same situation with Steve Nee Jones, who claimed to be interested in the truth of 9/11, but then he was lying about what was in Judy Wood's research, openly lying, which is not consistent. It's not self-consistent. In other words, you can't have somebody who claims to be a truth seeker openly lying and then being corrected, but then later lying again.
Kind of have to be a truth seeker or not. You're not both.
Right. Well, yeah, that's right. And then later it became even more apparent, because as I mentioned a while ago, Dr. Morgan Reynolds submitted a court case against some of the contractors that were used to create the NIST technical reports, and Dr. Judy Wood also submitted a court case, also under the auspices of Jerry Leapart, the Connecticut attorney. She also submitted a science fraud case against the contractors who were used by NIST to create these 10,000 pages of reports. And in doing that, before she did that, she had to do something under U.S. law to lay the foundation for the filing of a fraud case. And that was, she had to go through the motions of submitting a what's called a request for correction, an RFC, request for correction. Under your country's law, under US law, there is a law called the Data Quality Act. And if you as a company are paid money, or as a government organization are paid money, or pay money to somebody to produce a report, and that report is found to be incorrect, you can then request that the company or government agency corrects that report and issues a corrected version if you found errors, so you do that with a request for correction. And then if they don't reissue the report with those corrections, then you can file against them. You can file against them for damages. And so Dr. Wood submitted a request for correction to NIST in, April 2007. She wrote to NIST, Catherine Fletcher was the name of the lady, if I recall correctly. And she wrote to them and said, your reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center are incorrect on these counts, and she sent them a 50-page document to point out that the towers did not collapse. They turned to dust, and she used a number of pieces of evidence of the both the, as we said, like the seismic signature. That was one of the pieces of evidence that they ignored in their reports and didn't correctly address. So she pointed out that error and a number of others. And then, of course, they wrote back to her, cutting a long story short, said, no, you know, of course, nothing wrong with our reports. They're absolutely correct, and we're not going to correct them, so go away. And she then said, well, if you're going to say that, well, I'm going to sue you because you've committed fraud, or your contractors have committed fraud by taking public money to produce a report which is flawed, which is incorrect. And so she sued them, and within that court case was put the evidence for the use of directed energy weapons, which involves the effects seen on the buildings. And, for example, the buildings came down with no seismic signature, and also, for example, it was claimed to be fire that caused the destruction, or the most of it, fire and gravity, yet the streets were littered with unburned paper, and so forth. So, but what happened with Stephen E. Jones's group? There was himself, Stephen E. Jones, Richard Gage, Niels Harrett, Kevin Ryan, Bob McElvain. They also submitted a request for correction in 3 weeks after Dr. Judy Wood did, in I think late April or early May 2007. And funnily enough, in their request for correction, they claimed that NIST's report was incorrect, but they didn't mention the word thermite anywhere in their request for correction. They did link to Stephen E. Jones's paper, but they didn't discuss in any meaningful way the contents of that paper, in his words, a paper about the thermite research that he'd supposedly, allegedly done. So, peculiarly, they were moving forward on their best evidence to make a legal case against NIST, yet they didn't include any of that evidence in their request for correction, which formed the legal basis for their challenge. And you can go and check out these documents. They're all on the NIST website. I've got copies of them on my website and links to them. You could write to Stephen E. Jones, anyone who questions this, and ask him about this, if you so wished, to see if I'm making this up or misrepresenting it or whatever. So that's essentially proved to me beyond any reasonable doubt two things. Thermite was not involved in any significant way in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And the people that were putting forward this theory, Stephen E. Jones, Richard Gage, Niels Harrett and others, knew that it had no involvement. Because if they did not know that, if they genuinely, you know, believed and had the evidence that thermite was involved, they should have included that in their court case to make it self-consistent, if you see what I mean. If they knew what they were saying was true, they should have been ready to take that to court. But they apparently were not ready to do that because it was not in their documentation. So they must have been, as I understood things, deliberate disinformation. Whether it's like COINTELPRO or whatever, I don't know. But they were certainly they were trying to cover up the truth rather than reveal it.
Yeah, shame on them. I would have a school hood saying, liar, liar, pants on fire. Yeah. About what they're doing to be nice, because we shouldn't just be completely mean. They're at least opening minds, but they're blocking doors to the complete truth. And some other people who have...
The problem with that is people that prove it wrong. As soon as they hear something wrong, oh, the thermite was proved wrong, therefore I'm going to say a fallacy, and the whole conspiracy about it's all wrong now.
Yeah, oh yeah,
wrong thing. So therefore, it's all wrong. So they put that stuff in there on purpose because it's pretty believable.
It is. And I mean, I bought into the story originally. Bombs in the building. I thought that's what happened. Several years.
Gets in on that. They start following the rabbit trail all the way down. They think they're winning. They think they're on the. And then they find out. And then they're like, oh, I should have known it was a trick. It was a stupid conspiracy theory. And then that's it. They won't listen to anything else, and they're gone.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, and your credibility is shot once you, you know, once you change your story and so on. Your credibility is shot, and I think that's they designed it that way. And for example, Stephen E. Jones and Richard Gaze, they've been on the BBC. They both got on a BBC special, probably about 3 years ago now, and they both had quite a bit of time given to them.
That's the writer of that movement there, as pushing out the crazy stuff, and goes right down to the end of the trailer, the FEMA camps. Sorry, get off. You remind me of FEMA camps, Glenn Beck FEMA debunkation.
Now, we saw Judy Woods basically marginalized by even the likes of Jesse Ventura when he was doing a 9/11 episode, and he was basically saying, instead of calling it a direct evidence weapon, he was calling it like a death ray or some sort of laser. Like you were saying earlier, how you're calling it like some sort of... a name that isn't really taken serious. So now there is evidence that this direct energy weapon could have something to do with the Star Wars program, and it's more likely the direct evidence weapon is from what I'm seeing, and after watching numerous Judy Woods videos and checking the evidence for myself, a lot of that on your actual website, where for anyone listening, not only does he break down what is happening, but he'll provide the link, and there's always an audio and a video, and it's easy to follow along with. So one thing that a lot of people are bringing up now is this nuclear story, and I even came across a video about 2 days ago when I was researching for tonight, and this guy's name, it's a Russian, and his name is Dmitry, I believe.
Right. That's correct.
Now, what do you say to him? He's supposedly a nuclear intelligence officer for the Soviet Union, and he's saying that there was plans that the actual World Trade Center was built on the nuclear self-destruct button.
Yeah, that's right. Well, just a couple of things I'll just mention there. Yeah, it's a directed energy weapon. I think you were saying directed evidence. I know you probably sort of tried to get the questions out and things, but yeah, directed energy weapon is what actually. The correct term that is used to describe the weapon. Just clear that one up. Yes, this Dmitry Karlazov character appeared on the scene, and this was about 3 years ago. But as soon as he came onto the scene, and people started writing to me about this, because when things like this pop up on the scene, I tend to get, I wouldn't say hundreds of emails, but I probably get five or six, over a week or so. So, have you seen this latest YouTube video, And indeed, that was one of those. And this Dmitry Karlazov came out with this 26-part YouTube series. I think if you watched all of these parts, I think it was about 4 or 5 hours long. And he went through all this evidence, or supposed evidence. And he wrote to me as well. I think it was, even though other people had sent him it, I think he himself... found my YouTube channel at the time, and he wrote to me and he said, "Oh, I'd like you to watch my video, see what you think of it," which was quite unusual. I mean, I don't often get people like him. Excuse me, I don't often get people like him writing to me and saying, "Watch my video, please." And not many people that write to me have done their own, 26-part video series. I mean, that's quite a lot of time to invest in something like 4 hours, and it's reasonably well produced. He's got some graphics that he's drawn, and he's got a fairly good interviewer there who goes through it with him, and they've got a little studio type setup with, I think, a green screen at the back. It wasn't something that was done just sitting in front of a webcam, like a lot of these videos are now. They've gone to a bit more trouble than that. They'd at least set up a green screen, which you can do fairly easily, but it's still a few hours of work to actually set that up, And so he wrote to me and said, "Oh, you should watch these videos." And I watched about the first four. And I wrote to him and I said, "Well, where do you discuss Hurricane Erin in this then? And where do you discuss this? And where do you discuss that?" And he didn't. As it turned out, I think I ended up watching the whole thing or most of it. And these things just weren't discussed. He didn't discuss the toasted cars. He didn't discuss the buildings turning into dust. Well, he sort of did, but he claimed in one part that the nuclear explosion because these nukes were essentially built, they were built into the design of the building. They had these nuclear devices which were, you know, they were completely secret. Nobody would ever, admit that they were there. But they had to design this building so that it, at some point it could easily be destroyed, you know. He called it nuclear demolition. That was the title of his video. I think Nuclear Demolition on 9/11 or something. That was the original title.
As soon as I heard his theory about how it was like a pre-made detonation device, I just started thinking like the Inspector Gadget note. This messed himself up. Like, what does he come up with? The only thing that made me kind of question, is there any way that this was, he was actually telling the truth, was when he was saying that they were built under the Twin Towers and that they were also built under the Chicago Sears Tower. Now, I know that the 9/11 false flag, there's many different stories about it, but my research has led me to believe that there was going to be, or still coming up, a second attack on America, on American soil, like another false flag to move us farther along the agenda. And a lot of it has been referencing another nuclear detonation and the city of Chicago. So it kind of...
Right, right. I'll go back. I want to finish off Karlsov, but I'll just mention that briefly first. I've heard those stories as well. And I don't know whether they're true or not. The problem is that we don't have any real evidence to go on. I mean, there could be... You know, there could be nuclear devices planted. I mean, you know, if you listen to this Bill Deagle character, who I write about in another article, he claims that 22 U.S. cities have been pre-wired with nuclear explosives. That's what he claims, and he claims to have been told this by an insider in the Army intelligence. But unfortunately, I haven't seen any other evidence apart from this anonymous claim from this insider that Bill Deagle doesn't name, that this is true.
At that point, though, you know what I mean? It's almost laughable to try and explain to someone, hey, guess what? They've got 22 cities across America wired. Like, you can't start referencing this stuff to, like, if I was to explain my family what's going on, I can't even bring this up, you know what I mean? You get laughed at the dinner table. So I think this is another thing to mix up the whole story. And it's...
Exactly. And where you can't show any evidence of that, you know, if you say that to somebody who doesn't accept what's been going on, then, you know, he's just pointless saying it because you've no point of reference to move forward with it. And it's actually the same with most of that Dmitry Karlazov material once you unpick it. For example, he claims that the buildings were turned to dust by the nuclear explosion, but then if you look at one of the other graphics, he claims that the base of the buildings melted. As the base melted, because the nuclear furnace was still very hot, the building continued to sort of go down into this hot furnace type of situation and continually melted down, you know. And you can clearly see that just did not happen. If you look at the images, there is no evidence of high heat. There's no evidence of that level of heat at the World Trade Center site with these people. People would have been absolutely incinerated in the close vicinity of that. Yet he claims this happened underground, so the heat didn't, you know, go very far, and this sort of nonsense. We asked Dmitry Karlov, why wasn't the bathtub damaged? The bathtub was this slurry wall in which the World Trade Center was constructed. It was, I think, about 70 feet deep or something. And according to news reports, after the destruction of the World Trade Center, they were worried that driving in this earth-moving equipment that they were using to sort of clear out some of the remaining sort of structure that was left, because not all of the buildings were destroyed, only about 85% of them were turned to dust, something like that, 85-90%. So you still have 10%, you know, which is still a lot of material. And they were worried that using this earth moving equipment, if the shovels or the buckets or whatever were going to crash into the wall, it was going to damage the wall and it was going to leak, and then that would have flooded the lower Manhattan, because the Hudson River would have inundated the area. And that didn't happen. And when we asked Karlazov to explain how a nuke didn't create this effect, He didn't even know what the bathtub was. He didn't even know it was there. So if he's claiming that this, you know, his explanation is correct, then why hasn't he actually studied the architectural makeup of the site? He clearly hadn't studied that. And then later on, he claimed that he could explain it.
I think the bathtub, it debunks two theories. If the towers actually were in one piece or in big pieces and fell down, it would have ruptured that same thing falling through the basement. And there's no nuke going off causing the same thing. This was in my note. Make sure you bring up the bathtub.
Right.
Now, one thing, Paul and I's show, it airs every Wednesday, and it's usually just an hour long, so I knew that if we had a really long discussion that some of our listeners wouldn't be in, so we were going to try and maybe do this over a more than one occasion. Would it be possible to try you back again for another interview, not only on the 9/11 subject, but I know that looking at your website, you have articles on anti-gravity, crop circles, different... The moon hoax, consciousness, that's a big thing I was into, and some of the climate and chemtrail science. Would it be possible to get you back up for another interview?
Oh, sure, Yeah, anytime.
I definitely have more 9/11 things that I'd want to get into next time to start off an interview, and then maybe finish up with a lot of the other excellent work you've got. Checking the evidence. So anyone who wants to check out Andrew Johnson's website, it's checktheevidence.com. Is that's correct website?
That's correct, yeah. Or .co.uk, both take you to the same place, yep.
Okay, and Paul and I would definitely like to thank you for coming on, for spending definitely more than an hour for sure here. I think we got about an hour and a half of recording. This will be aired live on Wednesday at 8 p.m. on Global Fact Radio. It's the show called Truth Talk. This is episode 43. Now, we labeled it a kind of a coincidental name that this is 9/11 proof, or proof 9/11 was an inside job / check the evidence. So, I mean, like, it speaks for itself, folks. Once you start going through even just the research Andrew's posted, It's self-explanatory, and it's obvious that there's questions that happened, there's answers that have been found, and there's suppression of the cover-up. So it's completely crazy. Thanks for joining us. Paul, you want to say goodbye to our guest?
No, thanks a lot for joining us, Andrew. I appreciate your time, and keep up the good fight, man.
I will, and thank you very much for what you're doing.
Awesome. So we'll try and stay in touch through email, and we'll have you back on for another adventure on Truth Talk. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.